From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Westminster College President Michael Bassus has spent over 40 years in higher ed, and he's seen a few changes in the system, not all of them good. One thing he's particularly concerned about is the high cost of tuition. In an editorial last year, he wrote that over the past decade, tuition at Westminster increased faster than inflation, faster than the growth in family incomes, and even faster than the increase in health care spending. And he concluded that saddling students with large debt doesn't serve them or the college. So he and his colleagues set out to find ways to cut costs while enhancing instruction. Today on the program, Bassus joins me to talk about what he's learned. Plus, the search for a new president at the University of Utah. It's Higher Ed This Hour, plus your calls, coming up after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Today on the program, college tuition. Tuition over the last decade has skyrocketed. According to one economist, annual tuition hikes have outpaced health care costs, home prices, and all other consumer goods since 1978, rising an average of almost 7.5% a year. But Westminster College President Michael Bassus says it doesn't have to be this way. Colleges, he says, can trim costs without sacrificing quality. Dr. Michael Bassus joins me now to talk about the cost of higher ed and the lessons learned during his distinguished career. Michael Bassus is president of Westminster College in Salt Lake City, a post he's held since July 2002. Before coming to Westminster, he was dean of the University of South Florida, as well as at the New College in Sarasota, and president of Olivet College in Michigan. He has a doctorate in sociology of education from the University of Chicago, and he recently announced his retirement effective next June. And Dr. Bassus, thanks so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you. Pleasure to be here.
And we invite you to join the conversation with your questions or comments. Are you still paying off those college loans? What do you think is a fair price for a quality college education? 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Dr. Bassus, you began your journey in higher ed, gosh, it was 40 years ago. What were some of the challenges facing colleges and universities when you began on this path? And was the cost of tuition a top concern at that time?
Well, no, I don't think it was. Actually, that was an era of expansion in American higher education. Baby boomers were headed off for college, and now the whole system was exploding. So the issue was how to accommodate all these new college goers, and especially students from underrepresented groups.
You arrived at Westminster, as I mentioned, in 2002, and in the years since you've arrived, you've been a passionate advocate of reining in these costs of higher ed. What was it that began to focus your attention on this particular issue?
Well, I think we've heard for a long time that college is becoming increasingly unaffordable for too many Americans. And given the importance that a college education plays in helping someone to prepare for a career and a fulfilling life, that's really tragic. The problem is cost and quality have always been linked in higher education. Everyone wants to improve the quality of the educational experience, and the presumption was the only way to do that was to increase the cost, because we needed more books in the library, we needed more technology, we needed more professors with higher degrees, more of everything. And that, I think, is largely what has contributed to this cost spiral. Everyone wants to do a better job, and that costs more. Breaking that link between cost and quality is a really difficult issue.
Well, the conventional wisdom is you get what you pay for. So if you're willing to, you know, pay a top dollar, you are willing to get the best education that you can. So how can you separate those two? They do seem kind of inextricable.
Well, you know, higher education is an industry that has been very slow to change. As a matter of fact, I think For the most part, we're still using the model that was invented in the 15th century when colleges and universities first appeared, where there was someone who knew a lot of things, who got up in front of a group of students who didn't know so much and told them about it. And those students wrote it down, tried to learn as much as they can. Well, we're still using that basic methodology. Now, I think, given the wonders of technology, that's not a very efficient way to learn. It's not really a very effective way to learn either, because all sorts of research talks about how much material is retained when one is sitting in a lecture. But now students have access 24/7 to an incredible variety of learning resources. You don't need to sit in a classroom anymore to have access to the kind of information that you're seeking.
These ideas are quite controversial. Why did you decide to get out in front on this issue and say the educational model has changed? Because as you have written, this is the elephant in the room, you know, the cost-quality connection, but nobody wants to talk about it. Why did you decide to get out in front on this?
Well, I'm not the only one who's talking about this. I think I'm part of a growing chorus of people who are struggling to find ways to continue to have really powerful educational experiences without bankrupting the states or parents who are paying the bills.
Well, how do you think quality should be defined then? I mean, if it's not connected to cost, how should we say you are getting a quality education if you don't have, you know, the large library and the state-of-the-art laboratories on the campus? How should we redefine quality?
Well, the issue really is how much are students learning, rather than how many books are in the library, how big the endowment is, what kind of degrees their professors have. The real issue is maximizing the kind of learning that students are able to achieve. And that doesn't have to happen through the traditional mechanism. Let me give you one illustration. When I was an undergraduate, one of my favorite subjects was art history. Mm-hmm. And art history was taught in those days in a large lecture hall with a professor who was up in the front showing slides of the great works of art from across the world. The lights were low. You were struggling to stay awake.
I think everyone's had that experience.
Because you're sitting there in a really passive position, listening to someone and trying to grapple with that material. Now, the kind of technology that you've gotten in order to be able to learn something like art history is absolutely incredible. There's someone at Google who has, with a camera that has got almost a billion pixels, who has gone through the seven great art museums in the world, captured every picture, and now you can walk through those libraries with your mouse and get a better picture of each of those works of art than you could with a naked eye, and press a button and learn all about that author, learn all about that that period of art, that artistic tradition. And you do it as an active learner as opposed to a passive one sitting there and listening to someone.
So are you saying that a guided online tour with pop-ups that give you more kind of in-depth information, if you choose to click on that, that is better, a more effective way of teaching than having somebody who has been to and has studied all of the great works of art lecturing in front of a crowd?
Well, why lecture in front of a crowd? You can videotape the experts in a field who also happen to be the best lecturers. Why simply have to depend on someone who's on your same campus? But I think the real model is not just online learning. there's a good deal of research that shows that when online learning is combined with face-to-face learning in a hybrid model, that's when the learning gains are greatest. So, for example, in that art history course, accessing all of the riches of art history online and then being able to sit under the guidance of a faculty member and talk about those issues and explore them in some depth, that's a much more powerful educational model than simply trying to write down in the dark as much as you can about a given piece of work and then try to regurgitate it back on a test.
Hmm. We're speaking today with Dr. Michael Bassis. He's president of Westminster College in Salt Lake City, talking about the changing nature of higher ed and how it can be more efficient and effective. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Dr. Bassis, in some ways it sounds like it gets to the heart of the debate of the purpose of college, what we're talking about, the learning process and how we learn and hands-on learning as opposed to what we normally think of as the ivory tower, sitting back, cogitating, thinking deep thoughts about the philosophies of life and of artistic work. And that has kind of been the traditional role of the liberal arts college. Are you looking at a different definition of what a liberal arts college means?
No, I don't think so. I think it's more subtle than that. For example, one of the criticisms that many employers have is that the students who are graduating from college these days don't have the kinds of skills to be effective in the workplace. They say they know a good deal about the particular subject matter that they learned in school, but their ability to think critically and creatively, their ability to work as a team with others, their ability to solve problems, all of those are really underdeveloped, and I think that's because we have put too much stock in just the transfer of information. So at Westminster, we have developed what we call a set of college-wide learning goals. These are these skills and attributes that we think are important for success no matter what occupation one chooses, no matter what one ends up doing with one's life. And we're having students throughout our curriculums attending to that kind of learning and then documenting it in an electronic portfolio, illustrations of their best work that demonstrate achievement of all of these college-wide learning goals. Mm. That, I think, is getting to the heart of what's important to learning college, not just more details about American history or about 18th century history.
So it's application. It's, would you call it an apprenticeship in some ways?
Well, I think those are important. But to be able to think critically about something is a skill that you develop, and you have to be given practice in college doing that. Well, if you're sitting in a large lecture, writing down information, only expected to regurgitate it on a test, and you're not developing critical thinking skills. In most occupations, it's really very important for people to be able to work well with one another, especially in a diverse group. That's how a lot of work gets done in our society. But in school, students get very little practice working in groups. Everything is individualistic. And as a matter of fact, you'll hear students complain, I don't want to get a grade for what has happened in this a group learning project because someone else might be not carrying their weight, and that's unfair. Well, it really is a much more realistic exercise, though, in terms of what really happens in the world. And bringing that kind of realism to bear on a college education, I think, is really important.
We're speaking today with Westminster College President Michael Bassus, and we invite you to join the conversation. What do you expect to get for your college tuition dollars? 801-355-TALK is our number, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. We need to take a break, but we'll be back in a moment. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. I'm Jennifer Napier Pearson. This is City Views. Good morning. Today on the program, we're talking about the high cost of college tuition. Why does tuition keep going up, and what should institutions do to curb the cost? We invite you to join the conversation, 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Joining us this hour, Michael Bassus, president of Westminster College, the only private liberal arts college in Utah. And Dr. Bassus, you've written in editorials that professors should be less the sage on the stage to the guide on the side. Talk about the changing definition of what it means to be a professor.
Well, the sage on the stage is the faculty member standing up in front of a large group and lecturing at them, where the students are learning in a very passive way. If the students have access to the same kind of information and actually a much richer array of information than they could get from listening to a faculty member lecture, then they can use their time with that faculty member, I think, in much more richer and creative ways, where that faculty member is really helping you think about these different pieces of knowledge and how to think about them, how to put them together, how to manipulate them, how to apply them.
You have been starting to do this transition to the hybrid model. I'm wondering how students are thinking about it, how professors are thinking about how their profession is changing. What kind of reaction have you been hearing?
Well, we've just started with some pilot projects, and we started in our business school. We created a program at the undergraduate level and also at the MBA level. And these are really interesting because in order to earn the degree, students don't simply take a bunch of courses. In effect, there are no courses in these degree programs. What students do is to complete a series of projects that simulate real-world activity in the business world. Embedded in those projects are knowledge and skills that you need in order to be able to complete the project. Students access that knowledge and skills through a very rich repository of online learning materials that we put together. And then our faculty serve as coaches and mentors to those students as they're learning that material, as they're applying it to those projects. They interact with them online. They also interact with them in these intensive two-day residencies that are structured on the campus. And we've found that students appreciate this kind of learning to a much greater degree than the average student appreciates sitting in a class and learning in the traditional way. And we think the learning gains are higher. We haven't done the definitive studies on how much learning has increased in this model. We haven't done the definitive studies yet about how we can control costs in that model, but that is our goal, is to increase learning and to decrease the costs.
We're speaking with Michael Bassus, president of Westminster College. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number. And let's go to the phones. And Lily is joining us from Salt Lake City. Lily, welcome.
Thank you. I think my question is directed toward the president, and it is that I'm wondering about the availability of funds in the form of scholarships or grants for older students who are seeking advanced degrees. I have a daughter who just started the Master's in Education or Master's in Teaching program at Westminster, and she's thrilled. She's passionate about teaching, but she's also going to be starting her career with a lot of debt. And so I wonder if there are government programs or anything out there to help older students.
Lily, thanks for the call. President Bassus, this has been a top concern of yours.
Yeah, I think it's true that a good deal of the focus of financial aid has been on undergraduates trying to earn degrees, not so much at the graduate level. And things are really in flux with respect to financial aid for graduate students. As a matter of fact, given the federal legislation that was just passed this past summer, the loans that students might take out to finance their graduate education are going to be twice as expensive. The interest rate is going to double because the federal government is trying to save money and is eliminating some of its subsidies. But that being said, I think every student needs to make a judgment about whether or not this is a good investment for them. I think some programs are better investments than others. I think programs at Westminster College are terrific investments because we do try to keep the cost low and we try to keep the learning gains as high as possible. It's not just a matter of learning subject matter. This is a holistic, almost transformational learning process that we're trying to achieve at the college, both at the graduate as well as the undergraduate level. So I sympathize with the caller. I don't have a ready solution for it. And to tell you the truth, I don't even see one on the horizon. This is an issue that everybody's struggling with. We'd like to be able to design our programs in a way that we could offer them at a tuition that is lower than the way it is now, and we think we're making progress in that direction.
801-355-TALK is the number. Lily, thanks for the call. We're going to go to Juliana from Salt Lake City, now on the line. Juliana, welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
So I just wanted to – I love hearing this conversation. My father, Steve Sternfeld, is a professor up at the University of Utah, and he's been teaching courses like this for a while in cross-cultural communication where – you know, students are even putting to families online in groups of them or doing work together and actually practicing real world experiences with each other. And the results have been really mixed with students, like how they feel about it. Some are really, like you said, don't want to be accountable for other people, but then a lot of the ones that get it love it and feel like they've gotten a really incredible experience. So I appreciate that, you know, this is becoming more a part of the conversation at the administrative level and, you know, beyond for everyone.
Juliana, let me ask you about tuition, and maybe if your father's a professor, you're getting a tuition cut. But do you think that this idea that a quality higher education comes with a hefty price tag, that the two cannot be separated?
Well, I guess for me personally, I actually haven't ever gotten what you'd call a higher education. I was encouraged to, you know, even stop going to high school early and go to college, and it never worked out for me. I ended up with a young family, but I've actually pursued my education on my own. I find that through the internet and through, you know, different real world experiences that I have, that I've learned more about the field that interests me the most, which is lunar infertility awareness than I ever could have finding a program anywhere that would have teach me everything I want to know. So I think for some people, you know, the model doesn't work. For me, it didn't. And so I think there are a lot of people looking for different ways to get educated. And right now I see school getting a lot in the way of education for a lot of people. So,
Juliana, yeah. Thanks very much for the call. Dr. Bassus, this idea that you have to have a college degree in order to continue your learning, not necessarily the norm now.
Well, I am an unabashed advocate for a college degree. I think the kinds of learning gains that students achieve there are phenomenal and terribly important. That doesn't mean that there aren't students who can learn on their own, who are self-directed learners, and I applaud that. But if you think about what you learn, what you know once you graduate with a degree, and all the kinds of learning that is still in front of you, you won't be sitting in a class as you had been in school. You have to be a self-directed learner if you're going to continue to keep up with the explosion of knowledge, the rapid changes in the world, the changes that are happening in every occupation, every profession. So if we can teach students how to learn, give them that experience in college, they're going to be much better off as continuing learners well after graduation.
Mm. Juliana, thanks for the call. 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. We're speaking with Michael Bassus, president of Westminster College. President Bassus, you recently announced that you're going to be stepping down at the end of the year. And I guess I want to have you reflect on your tenure at Westminster. I understand that enrollment at Westminster has grown 44% during your tenure. A majority of students are coming from out of state, the first time in the college's history. What do you see as sort of your crowning achievements at Westminster?
Well, let me say to begin with that Westminster really is an extraordinary school and has been for a good long while. It has combined two things that are not often combined in American higher education. One, students are held to very high standards for learning. They are challenged to learn a lot. At the same time, Westminster faculty give our students enormous levels of support to be able to meet those high standards. Typically in schools, you'll either find the great challenge, but not much support for meeting it, or vice versa. And that, I think, has been a strength of Westminster's for a good long while. But I think the school's aspirations have grown over time. It used to be, I think, that too many people were content to have Westminster simply be the best little college in Sugar House. That's no longer the case. We think we are as good, at least as good, as lots of colleges across the country, and we think we deserve the kind of national recognition that might come with that. And so we have been trying to recruit students from other states, from other countries, and we've been very successful at that because I think we've sort of been discovered by lots of students and parents who are looking for a quality education at a more affordable price. It's been a wonderful 9 years. I've got one more to go. The college has made incredible progress. And I think when I do step down, I am going to feel like I've left the college in pretty good shape.
Mm. Let's go back to the phones. 801-355-TALK is our number. Michelle is joining us from Salt Lake City. Michelle, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to call and comment about the speaker. I absolutely applaud the idea of getting more real-world experience for college graduates. I'm a recent college graduate. I've been in the out in the professional world for a number of years, went back as an adult learner. But what I found when they tried to do that in any of my classes is it did not resemble any real-world experience. In real-world experience, as you move through your professional life, natural selection kind of tends to put people who with ability and drive together versus when you are shuffled about in a class, you know, someone who's very motivated ends up being can be put with people who are not so motivated. So you end up usually having two out of a group of five people doing everything and the other three maybe not contributing.
But Michelle, isn't that real life? Isn't that how it works in the workplace sometimes?
No, people get fired.
guess you're right.
In college, however, you know, you can move on to the next class, people, you know, who are C averages, A averages. But at the end of the day, the people who have the more drive end up doing a lot of the work. Yeah, you know, I saw it with a lot of people. And you take the good with the bad, but if someone is really trying, it really does detriment you as far as how much work effort you have to put into a particular project that takes away from your other classes.
Hmm. Michelle, thanks for the call. Dr. Bassus, what about that point that a group simulation at college is just not the same as real-world learning, and it can't it can't possibly properly prepare you for what it's like to be out in the dog-eat-dog world of finance or whatever field you choose.
Well, I think that's not our experience. Certainly, the caller is right that sometimes the imbalance in student contributions to a given project are way out of whack. But I think that happens in the real world as well. I think it would be a shame if students ended up earning a college degree, going in the workplace, and then finding for the first time that they have to now develop skills in being able to work productively as a team with different people, with different skills, with different perspectives. That's a fact of life in modern society. And I think it's our obligation, even if it's even if how we do it is a bit imperfect, to give students those kinds of experiences when they're in school.
Michelle, thanks for the call. Dr. Bassus, I want to revisit this idea of quality and the connection with cost. It does seem so hard to separate those two. Can the college of the future have an affordable education and still have this perception that, yes, you know, we don't have to pay an arm and a leg to get that? It seems like you say that there is a growing chorus of people in higher ed who are saying, yes, we do need to revamp this paradigm, but it does seem like it's hitting against the waves in some ways, that it's a challenge. How can you change that paradigm? A complete overhaul.
Well, actually, I think it's going to change almost no matter what we do in colleges or universities, because people are developing programs that are very powerful learning programs that they can deliver at a lower cost. And that is only going to increase over the next 5 and 10 years as the technology for delivering education becomes better and better. There are venture capitalists in this country who are pouring billions of dollars into products designed to make the learning more powerful and less expensive. And venture capitalists are often the ones who are looking over the horizon, trying to see what the new developments are, the kinds of things that that need to be fixed. And I think that's happening in higher education. So schools that don't change, I think, will have a harder time. There are some exceptions to that. Schools that are at the top of the prestige hierarchy, oftentimes with billion-dollar endowments, they've got little incentive to change, and the prestige of their degrees is so high that they can pretty much do anything they want. I think the same is true for large state universities, where their research programs and their football teams generate enough prestige so that they're going to attract students no matter what happens educationally. But 95% of the students going to college in this country don't go to either of those kinds of schools. They go to the Westminster Colleges. They go to the Weber States, public and private schools, who do a great job. I think who are going to be the leaders in this change movement, because we have to be more adaptable to changing circumstances.
So what does the college of the future look like? What does Westminster College look like in 20 years, in 25 years?
You know, the world is changing so quickly that I can't draw a picture of that. As I try to look over the horizon, I'm only guessing as to what it might look like. I do think it's going to be the kind of residential, holistic, transformational learning experience that Westminster has always provided. There'll continue to be a place for that. I hope there will be a place for that at Westminster. At the same time, I think these technological advances are moving so quickly to deliver powerful learning experiences at a lower price that's going to be an inevitable part of what we mix in to what has always been the magic of a school like Westminster. How that mix takes place, how quickly, how it takes place in different disciplines, how it takes place at the undergraduate versus the graduate level, I think are things that we'll simply have to discover.
Hmm. When you started your career 40 plus years ago, could you have imagined where you'd be today and what the college looks like today, what the college setting, the environment looks like today?
Well, in many regards, it doesn't look that much different. I think the industry has been pretty stable, has been slow to change. Some people think that's a terrific thing because what's been happening at colleges and universities is great. Others look at that and say students are being shortchanged on two accounts. One, the kind of learning that takes place there is not as rich and as deep as it ought to be. And second of all, it's costing too much. I'm optimistic about the future of higher education, but I do think it's going to be a future that is going to entail much more change in the way higher education is delivered and is experienced than there has been over the course of my 40 years.
Michael Bassus, Westminster College President, thanks very much for your time. I do appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And you can continue the discussion online at kcpw.org. Up next, we're going to continue our higher ed theme with the conversation, an update on the search for a new president at the University of Utah. But first, we need to take another break. Back in a moment. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Today on the program, college tuition. Tuition over the last decade has skyrocketed. According to one economist, annual tuition hikes have outpaced health care costs, home prices, and all other consumer goods since 1978, rising an average of almost 7.5% a year. But Westminster College President Michael Bassus says it doesn't have to be this way. Colleges, he says, can trim costs without sacrificing quality. Dr. Michael Bassus joins me now to talk about the cost of higher ed and the lessons learned during his distinguished career. Michael Bassus is president of Westminster College in Salt Lake City, a post he's held since July 2002. Before coming to Westminster, he was dean of the University of South Florida, as well as at the New College in Sarasota, and president of Olivet College in Michigan. He has a doctorate in sociology of education from the University of Chicago, and he recently announced his retirement effective next June. And Dr. Bassus, thanks so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you. Pleasure to be here.
And we invite you to join the conversation with your questions or comments. Are you still paying off those college loans? What do you think is a fair price for a quality college education? 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Dr. Bassus, you began your journey in higher ed, gosh, it was 40 years ago. What were some of the challenges facing colleges and universities when you began on this path? And was the cost of tuition a top concern at that time?
Well, no, I don't think it was. Actually, that was an era of expansion in American higher education. Baby boomers were headed off for college, and the whole system was exploding. So the issue was how to accommodate all these new college goers, and especially students from underrepresented groups.
You arrived at Westminster, as I mentioned, in 2002, and in the years since you've arrived, you've been a passionate advocate of reining in these costs of higher ed. What was it that began to focus your attention on this particular issue?
Well, I think we've heard for a long time that college is becoming increasingly unaffordable for too many Americans. And given the importance that a college education plays in helping someone to prepare for a career and a fulfilling life, that's really tragic. The problem is cost and quality have always been linked in higher education. Everyone wants to improve the quality of the educational experience, and the presumption was the only way to do that was to increase the cost, because we needed more books in the library, we needed more technology, we needed more professors with higher degrees. more of everything. And that, I think, is largely what has contributed to this cost spiral. Everyone wants to do a better job, and that costs more. Breaking that link between cost and quality is a really difficult issue.
Well, the conventional wisdom is you get what you pay for. So if you're willing to, you know, pay a top dollar, you are willing to get the best education that you can. So how can you separate those two? They do seem kind of inextricable.
Well, you know, higher education is an industry that has been very slow to change. As a matter of fact, I think for the most part, we're still using the model that was invented in the 15th century when colleges and universities first appeared, where there was someone who knew a lot of things, who got up in front of a group of students who didn't know so much and told them about it. And those students wrote it down, tried to learn as much as they can. Well, we're still using that basic methodology. Now, I think, given the wonders of technology, that's not a very efficient way to learn. It's not really a very effective way to learn either, because all sorts of research talks about how much material is retained when one is sitting in a lecture. But now students have access 24/7 to an incredible variety of learning resources. You don't need to sit in a classroom anymore to have access to the kind of information that you're seeking.
These ideas are quite controversial. Why did you decide to get out in front on this issue and say the educational model has changed? Because as you have written, this is the elephant in the room, you know, the cost-quality connection, but nobody wants to talk about it. Why did you decide to get out in front on this?
Well, I'm not the only one who's talking about this. I think I'm part of a growing chorus of people who are struggling to find ways to continue to have really powerful educational experiences without bankrupting states or parents who are paying the bills.
Well, how do you think quality should be defined then? I mean, if it's not connected to cost, how should we say you are getting a quality education if you don't have, you know, the large library and the state-of-the-art laboratories on the campus? How should we redefine quality?
Well, the issue really is how much are students learning rather than how many books are in the library, how big the endowment is, what kind of degrees their professors have. The real issue is maximizing the kind of learning that students are able to achieve. And that doesn't have to happen through the traditional mechanism. Let me give you one illustration. When I was an undergraduate, one of my favorite subjects was art history.
Mm-hmm.
And art history was taught in those days in a large lecture hall with a professor who was up in the front showing slides of the great works of art from across the world. The lights were low. You were struggling to stay awake.
I think everyone's had that experience.
Because you're sitting there in a really passive position, listening to someone and trying to grapple with that material. Now, the kind of technology that you've gotten in order to be able to learn something like art history is absolutely incredible. There's someone at Google who has, with a camera that has got almost a billion pixels, who has gone through the seven great art museums in the world, captured every picture, and now you can walk through those libraries with your mouse and get a better picture of each of those works of art than you could with a naked eye, and press a button and learn all about that author, learn all about that that period of art, that artistic tradition. And you do it as an active learner as opposed to a passive one sitting there and listening to someone.
So are you saying that a guided online tour with pop-ups that give you more kind of in-depth information, if you choose to click on that, that is better, a more effective way of teaching than having somebody who has been to and has studied all of the great works of art lecturing in front of a crowd?
Well, why lecture in front of a crowd? You can videotape the experts in a field who also happen to be the best lecturers. Why simply have to depend on someone who's on your same campus? But I think the real model is not just online learning. There's a good deal of research that shows that when online learning is combined with face-to-face learning in a hybrid model, that's when the learning gains are greatest. So, for example, in that art history course, accessing all of the riches of art history online and then being able to sit under the guidance of a faculty member and talk about those issues and explore them in some depth. That's a much more powerful educational model than simply trying to write down in the dark as much as you can about a given piece of work and then try to regurgitate it back on a test.
Hmm. We're speaking today with Dr. Michael Bassis. He's president of Westminster College in Salt Lake City, talking about the changing nature of higher ed and how it can be more efficient and effective. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Dr. Bassis, in some ways it sounds like it gets to the heart of the debate of the purpose of college, what we're talking about, the learning process and how we learn and hands-on learning as opposed to what we normally think of as the ivory tower, sitting back, cogitating, thinking deep thoughts about the philosophies of life and of artistic work. And that has kind of been the traditional role of the liberal arts college. Are you looking at a different definition of what a liberal arts college means?
No, I don't think so. I think it's more subtle than that. For example, one of the criticisms that many employers have is that the students who are graduating from college these days don't have the kinds of skills to be effective in the workplace. They say they know a good deal about the particular subject matter that they learned in school, but their ability to think critically and creatively, their ability to work as a team with others, their ability to solve problems, all of those are really underdeveloped. And I think that's because we have put too much stock in just the transfer of information. So at Westminster, we have developed what we call a set of college-wide learning goals. These are these skills and attributes that we think are important for success no matter what occupation one chooses, no matter what one ends up doing with one's life. And we're having students throughout our curriculums attending to that kind of learning and then documenting it in an electronic portfolio, illustrations of their best work that demonstrate achievement of all of these college-wide learning goals. Mm. That, I think, is getting to the heart of what's important to learning college, not just more details about American history or about 18th century history.
So it's application. It's, would you call it an apprenticeship in some ways?
Well, I think those are important. But to be able to think critically about something is a skill that you develop, and you have to be given practice in college doing that. Well, if you're sitting in a large lecture, writing down information, only expected to regurgitate it on a test, and you're not developing critical thinking skills. In most occupations, it's really very important for people to be able to work well with one another, especially in a diverse group. That's how a lot of work gets done in our society. But in school, students get very little practice working in groups. Everything is individualistic. And as a matter of fact, you'll hear students complain I don't want to get a grade for what has happened in this group learning project because someone else might be not carrying their weight, and that's unfair. Well, it really is a much more realistic exercise, though, in terms of what really happens in the world. And bringing that kind of realism to bear on a college education, I think, is really important.
We're speaking today with Westminster College President Michael Bassus, and we invite you to join the conversation. What do you expect to get for your college tuition dollars? 801-355-TALK is our number, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. We need to take a break, but we'll be back in a moment. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City.
On the next Fresh Air, where the idea for the show Breaking Bad came from. We'll talk to Vince Gilligan. He's the show's executive producer. And we'll also hear from Aaron Paul, whose character has evolved into one tough drug dealer. Join us.
Tune in later today at 1 on KCPW.
I'm Lise Doucette. Join me for News Hour from the BBC, weekdays at 2 p.m. on KCPW.
Support for KCPW's programming is sponsored in part by Fidelity Investments Orem Investor Center, located next to the University Mall. Information at 1-800-FIDELITY or fidelity.com. Fidelity Brokerage Services, member NYSE, SIPC.
Hi, I'm Andrew Shaw with the City Library. In his latest book, Everett Roos, His Short Life, Mysterious Death, and Astonishing Afterlife, author Philip Fradkin goes beyond the myth of Roos to reveal a troubled, idealistic adolescent who flirted with death and loss. Fradkin is speaking at the main library at 7 p.m. on Wednesday, September 21st. More information is available by visiting the City Library's website, slcpl.org.
I'm Jennifer Napier Pearson. This is City Views. Good morning. Today on the program, we're talking about the high cost of college tuition. Why does tuition keep going up, and what should institutions do to curb the cost? We invite you to join the conversation, 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Joining us this hour, Michael Bassus, president of Westminster College, the only private liberal arts college in Utah. And Dr. Bassus, you've written in editorials that professors should be less the sage on the stage to the guide on the side. Talk about the changing definition of what it means to be a professor.
Well, the sage on the stage is the faculty member standing up in front of a large group and lecturing at them, where the students are learning in a very passive way. If the students have access to the same kind of information and actually a much richer array of information than they could get from listening to a faculty member lecture, then they can use their time with that faculty member, I think, in much more richer and creative ways, where that faculty member is really helping you think about these different pieces of knowledge and how to think about them, how to put them together, how to manipulate them, how to apply them.
You have been starting to do this this transition to the hybrid model. I'm wondering how students are thinking about it, how professors are thinking about how their profession is changing. What kind of reaction have you been hearing?
Well, we've just started with some pilot projects, and we started in our business school. We created a program at the undergraduate level and also at the MBA level. And these are really interesting because in order to earn the degree, students don't simply take a bunch of courses. In effect, there are no courses in these degree programs. What students do is to complete a series of projects that simulate real-world activity in the business world. Embedded in those projects are knowledge and skills that you need in order to be able to complete the project. Students access that knowledge and skills through a very rich repository of online learning materials that we've put together. And then our faculty serve as coaches and mentors to those students as they're learning that material, as they're applying it to those projects. They interact with them online. They also interact with them in these intensive two-day residencies that are structured on the campus. And we've found that students appreciate this kind of learning to a much greater degree than the average student appreciates sitting in a class and learning in the traditional way. And we think the learning gains are higher. We haven't done the definitive studies on how much learning has increased in this model. We haven't done the definitive studies yet about how we can control costs in that model, but that is our goal, is to increase learning and to decrease the costs.
We're speaking with Michael Bassis, president of Westminster College. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number. And let's go to the phones. And Lily is joining us from Salt Lake City. Lily, welcome.
Thank you. I think my question is directed toward the president, and it is that I'm wondering about the availability of funds in the form of scholarships or grants for older students who are seeking advanced degrees. I have a daughter who just started the Master's in Education or Master's in Teaching program at Westminster, and she's thrilled. She's passionate about teaching, but she's also going to be starting her career with a lot of debt. And so I wonder if there are government programs or anything out there to help older students.
Lily, thanks for the call. President Bassis, this has been a top concern of yours.
Yeah, I think it's true that a good deal of the focus of financial aid has been on undergraduates trying to earn degrees, not so much at the graduate level. And things are really in flux with respect to financial aid for graduate students. As a matter of fact, given the federal legislation that was just passed this past summer, the loans that students might take out to finance their graduate education are going to be twice as expensive. The interest rate is going to double because the federal government is trying to save money and is eliminating some of its subsidies. But that being said, I think every student needs to make a judgment about whether or not this is a good investment for them. I think some programs are better investments than others. I think programs at Westminster College are terrific investments because we do try to keep the cost low and we try to keep the learning gains as high as possible. It's not just a matter of learning subject matter. This is a holistic, almost transformational learning process that we're trying to achieve at the college, both at the graduate as well as the undergraduate level. So I sympathize with the caller. I don't have a ready solution for it. And to tell you the truth, I don't even see one on the horizon. This is an issue that everybody's struggling with. We'd like to be able to design our programs in a way that we could offer them at a tuition that is lower than the way it is now, and we think we're making progress in that direction.
801-355-TALK is the number. Lily, thanks for the call. We're going to go to Juliana from Salt Lake City now on the line. Juliana, welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
So I just wanted to – I love hearing this conversation. My father, Steve Sternfeld, is a professor up at the University of Utah, and he's been teaching courses like this for a while in cross-cultural communication where – you know, students are even putting to families online and groups of them are doing work together and actually practicing real-world experiences with each other. And the results have been really mixed with students, like how they feel about it. Some are really, like you said, don't want to be accountable for other people, but then a lot of the ones that get it love it and feel like they've gotten a really incredible experience. So I appreciate that, you know, this is becoming more a part of the conversation at the administrative level, and you know, beyond for everyone.
Juliana, let me ask you about tuition, and maybe if your father's a professor, you're getting a tuition cut. But do you think that this idea that a quality higher education comes with a hefty price tag, that the two cannot be separated?
Well, I guess for me personally, I actually haven't ever gotten what you'd call a higher education. I was encouraged to, you know, even stop going to high school early and go to college, and it never worked out for me. I ended up with a young family, but I've actually pursued my education on my own. I find that through the internet and through, you know, different real world experiences that I have, that I've learned more about the field that interests me the most, which is lunar infertility awareness, than I ever could have finding a program anywhere that would have teach me everything I want to know. So I think for some people, you know, the model doesn't work. For me, it didn't. And so I think there are a lot of people looking for different ways to get educated. And right now I see school getting a lot in the way of education for a lot of people. So,
Juliana, yeah. Thanks very much for the call. Dr. Bassus, this idea that you have to have a college degree in order to continue your learning, not necessarily the norm now.
Well, I am an unabashed advocate for a college degree. I think the kinds of learning gains that students achieve there are phenomenal and terribly important. That doesn't mean that there aren't students who can learn on their own, who are self-directed learners, and I applaud that. But if you think about what you learn, what you know once you graduate with a degree, and all the kinds of learning that is still in front of you, you won't be sitting in a class as you had been in school. You have to be a self-directed learner in order, if you're going to continue to keep up with the explosion of knowledge, the rapid changes in the world, the changes that are happening in every occupation, every profession. So if we can teach students how to learn, give them that experience in college, they're going to be much better off as continuing learners well after graduation.
Mm. Juliana, thanks for the call. 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. We're speaking with Michael Bassus, president of Westminster College. President Bassus, you recently announced that you're going to be stepping down at the end of the year. And I guess I want to have you reflect on your tenure at Westminster. I understand that enrollment at Westminster has grown 44% during your tenure. A majority of students are coming from out of state, the first time in the college's history. What do you see as sort of your crowning achievements at Westminster?
Well, let me say to begin with that Westminster really is an extraordinary school and has been for a good long while. It has combined two things that are not often combined in American higher education. One, students are held to very high standards for learning. They are challenged to learn a lot. At the same time, Westminster faculty give our students enormous levels of support to be able to meet those high standards. Typically in schools, you'll either find the great challenge, but not much support for meeting it, or vice versa. And that, I think, has been a strength of Westminster's for a good long while. But I think the school's aspirations have grown over time. It used to be, I think, that too many people were content to have Westminster simply be the best little college in Sugar House. That's no longer the case. We think we are as good, at least as good, as lots of colleges across the country, and we think we deserve the kind of national recognition that might come with that. And so we have been trying to recruit students from other states, from other countries, and we've been very successful at that because I think we've sort of been discovered by lots of students and parents who are looking for a quality education at a more affordable price. So it's been a wonderful 9 years. I've got one more more to go. The college has made incredible progress. And I think when I do step down, I am going to feel like I've left the college in pretty good shape.
Mm. Let's go back to the phones. 801-355-TALK is our number. Michelle is joining us from Salt Lake City. Michelle, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to call and comment about the speaker. I absolutely applaud the idea of getting more real-world experience for college graduates. I'm a recent college graduate. I've been in the out in the professional world for a number of years, went back as an adult learner. But what I found when they tried to do that in any of my classes is it did not resemble any real-world experience. In real-world experience, as you move through your professional life, natural selection kind of tends to put people who with ability and drive together versus when you are shuffled about in a class, you know, someone who's very motivated ends up being, can be put with people who are not so motivated. So you end up usually having two out of a group of five people doing everything and the other three maybe not contributing.
But Michelle, isn't that real life? Isn't that how it works in the workplace sometimes?
No, people get fired.
I guess you're right.
In college, however, you know, you can move on to the next class, people, you know, who are C averages, A averages. But at the end of the day, the people who have the more drive end up doing a lot of the work. Yeah, you know, I saw it with a lot of people. And you take the good with the bad, but if someone is really trying, it really does detriment you as far as how much work effort you have to put into a particular project that takes away from your other classes.
Hmm. Michelle, thanks for the call. Dr. Bassus, what about that point that a group simulation at college is just not the same as real-world learning, and it can't possibly properly prepare you for what it's like to be out in the dog-eat-dog world of finance or whatever field you choose?
Well, I think that's not our experience. Certainly, the caller is right that sometimes the imbalance in student contributions to a given project are way out of whack. But I think that happens in the real world as well. I think it would be a shame if students ended up earning a college degree, going in the workplace, and then finding for the first time that they have to now develop skills in being able to work productively as a team with different people, with different skills, with different perspectives. That's a fact of life in modern society. And I think it's our obligation, even if it's how we do it is a bit imperfect, to give students those kinds of experiences when they're in school.
Michelle, thanks for the call. Dr. Bassus, I want to revisit this idea of quality and the connection with cost. It does seem so hard to separate those two. Can the college of the future have an affordable education and still have this perception that, yes, you know, we don't have to pay an arm and a leg to get that? It seems like you say that there is a growing chorus of people in higher ed who are saying, yes, we do need to revamp this paradigm. But it does seem like it's hitting against the waves in some ways, that it's a challenge. How can you change that paradigm, a complete overhaul?
Well, actually, I think it's going to change almost no matter what we do in colleges or universities, because people are developing programs that are very powerful learning programs that they can deliver at a lower cost. And that is only going to increase over the next 5 and 10 years as the technology for delivering education becomes better and better. There are venture capitalists in this country who are pouring billions of dollars into products designed to make the learning more powerful and less expensive. And venture capitalists are often the ones who are looking over the horizon, trying to see what the new developments are, the kinds of things that that need to be fixed. And I think that's happening in higher education. So schools that don't change, I think, will have a harder time. There are some exceptions to that. Students, schools that are at the top of the prestige hierarchy oftentimes with billion-dollar endowments. They've got little incentive to change, and the prestige of their degrees is so high that they can pretty much do anything they want. I think the same is true for large state universities, where their research programs and their football teams generate enough prestige so that they're going to attract students no matter what happens educationally. But 95% of the students going to college in this country don't go to either of those kinds of schools. They go to the Westminster Colleges. They go to the Weber States, public and private schools, who do a great job. I think who are going to be the leaders in this change movement, because we have to be more adaptable to changing circumstances.
So what does the college of the future look like? What does Westminster College look like in 20 years, in 25 years?
You know, the world is changing so quickly that I can't draw a picture of that. As I try to look over the horizon, I'm only guessing as to what it might look like. I do think it's going to be the kind of residential, holistic, transformational learning experience that Westminster has always provided. There'll continue to be a place for that. I hope there will be a place for that at Westminster. At the same time, I think these technological advances are moving so quickly to deliver powerful learning experiences at a lower price that that's going to be an inevitable part of what we mix in to what has always been the magic of a school like Westminster. How that mix takes place, how quickly, how it takes place in different disciplines, how it takes place at the undergraduate versus the graduate level, I think are things that that we'll simply have to discover.
Hmm. When you started your career 40-plus years ago, could you have imagined where you'd be today and what the college looks like today, what the college setting, the environment looks like today?
Well, in many regards, it doesn't look that much different. I think the industry has been pretty stable, has been slow to change. Some people think that's a terrific thing because what's been happening at colleges and universities is great. Others look at that and say students are being shortchanged on two accounts. One, the kind of learning that takes place there is not as rich and as deep as it ought to be. And second of all, it's costing too much. I'm optimistic about the future of higher education, but I do think it's going to be a future that is going to entail much more change in the way higher education is delivered and is experienced than there has been over the course of my 40 years.
Michael Bassus, Westminster College President, thanks very much for your time. I do appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And you can continue the discussion online at kcpw.org. Up next, we're going to continue our higher ed theme with the conversation, an update on the search for a new president at the University of Utah. But first, we need to take another break. Back in a moment. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City.
Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, will Europe pull together or come apart? We'll look at the stakes and consequences, plus the science of willpower, how to build it, what it can and cannot do. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR. This morning from 10 until noon on NPR Utah KCPW.
I'm Christy Smith, inviting you to listen to KCPW each weekday afternoon at 3:45 for Christy the Wordsmith, a fascinating two-minute interlude where I explore the rich and ever-changing words in our English language, the history behind them, how we use them, and how we change them. I hope you'll join me.
KCPW's broadcast of Christy the Wordsmith is sponsored by Tabula Rasa Social Stationers in Trolley Square, open 7 days a week. Tabula Rasa, when words really do matter.
The Downtown Alliance presents the 19th Annual Downtown Farmers Market. opening Saturday mornings, June 11th, and Tuesday evenings, August through October. Our vendors feature local flavors of seasonal produce, meats, cheeses, and more. Art and craft vendors also provide handcrafted creations. Details online at downtownslc.org. KCPW is proud to sponsor the 2011 Downtown Farmers Market.
I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Welcome back. The search for a new president at the University of Utah is on, and you're invited to give your two cents on who should be the next president. Joining me now to talk about the search is Cameron Martin. He is an associate commissioner for the Utah Office of Higher Education. And Cameron Martin, thanks so much for coming.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
If you're a professor or a student at the university, what would you like to see in a new president? What skills does that person need to have in a Pac-12 world? Give us a call, 801-355-TALK or 801-355-8255, or you can send emails to cityviews@kcpw.org. Cameron Martin, what are you looking for in the next president of the University of Utah? What's the job description?
Well, that's a loaded question, and it's kind of fun to host a series of constituent meetings and get the feedback from the variety of constituents, from faculty, staff, students, donors, alumni, general business leaders, and so forth. It's really their perception, their understanding of what they're looking for in the next president that we as a presidential search committee are interested in tapping into. There are the critics out there who could say, you could sum it all up, that if not deity, need not apply, because everybody wants everything in that job description. But it's been a great, rich experience to learn from the general public what they're looking for in the next president.
Okay. So what does that look like? What do people want so far? The people who have chimed in during this public process, what do they want?
Well, they want to make sure that the trajectory of the university is maintained, because it's on such an upward trajectory and so many positives from research and the student experience and, as you mentioned, the athletic experience. There's so much positive momentum. They want to see that continued. They're looking for shared governance, the values of the institution to persist and to grow and to evolve even greater. They're looking for somebody of integrity. They're looking for somebody who can find the balance between the academic mission, the research mission, the student mission, all these various missions of the institution, and lead it forward in a very positive manner. A good listener, a good communicator, somebody who can connect with the legislature, somebody who can truly be a champion of education for the state, in particular higher education. It's a flagship institution of our state, and really leverage that office appropriately so to the better good of the state, which is also the better good of the institution, students, faculty, and staff.
As you mentioned, this is a public search. You are inviting people to nominate candidates, to chime in and say what they would like to see from a new president at the University of Utah. I guess the question is, why should we in the public care about this? Isn't this just a position that, you know, should go through the normal hiring process? You select the best candidates from higher education and put that person in there.
Well, it is a normal search process, actually, but you should care because it is a public institution. It is a place, again, of great and tremendous influence for the state. We're engaging the public because the public is the greatest stakeholder in the institution's well-being. So we tap in and are wanting to engage the public, keep a very transparent process rolling where everybody can be engaged, understand what's going on, why we're doing it. Now, there's times of confidentiality because you need to protect the interests of possible candidates. You know, rumor mills always like to go on. And there have been articles rumoring this person or that person. And they can actually hurt the person if they are a candidate or not in their current position. Getting back to your original question, though, why engage the public? Because it's a public institution. And we would love for the various constituents to say, that's our person. He or she is the person we agree and support, so that they're not having whoever selected having to go back and win over people. If we bring them along in the process, hopefully they can really hit the ground running and have great success.
Hmm. What makes the University of Utah an especially attractive employment opportunity right now? What are the selling points that you're trying to get to potential candidates?
Well, as I said earlier, the trajectory is fantastic, you know, athletically, in the Pac-12. And like it or not, you're known academically by who you play athletically. So the profile of the institution's been elevated a hundredfold. There's all this great research, Nobel laureate with Mario Capecchi and the student experience. There's all this great trajectory, but what would probably distinguish this search over other flagship-type searches in the country is the financial stability of the institution. The University of Utah is well-managed. It's not in fiscal disarray. They're not having to come in, he or she, whoever's selected, come in and whack 30% off the budget, which has been, you know, that's the reality of some of these other searches nationally. So we feel that we can attract top-tier talent to the institution because of how healthy it is and the upward trajectory.
Is that commentary on the legacy of former U of U president Michael Young?
Sure. Sure. I think Michael did a great job. But what he did best was he surrounded himself with outstanding people. The cabinet at the institution, the presidential cabinet, top-tier talent, wonderful people, very collegial, very supportive. It's not a cutthroat environment at the University of Utah. We recently had our national search firm who was assisting us in the search come to campus, and they walked away thinking, all right, this is amazing, because we always come away and there's pockets of resistance here or there. But they noted this is a very collegial culture. And this cabinet is superb. And so kudos to President Mike Young for having a great cabinet. And I would say the leadership throughout, at the dean's level and at the department levels, all up to the vice presidential level, they're great people who are doing the right things for the right reasons. It really is. I'm not just overselling it. It is truly a great culture at the U.
In addition to stellar academic and demonstrated leadership credentials, what I hear you're saying is that this needs to be a good personality fit, too. It needs to be somebody who maintains the unity of the research branch and the humanities branch of the university and the athletics and all of these different interests that could have very competing interests in their standing at the university.
Well, even though I'm saying it's a very collegial environment, let's not say that there's not positioning and trying to improve each area of the campus, but it's also a mature campus in the sense that it knows what its mission is and is trying to do. The point that you make is important. This person also needs to understand that the institution is also part of a greater network of higher educational institutions, reporting to the Board of Regents. And the regents are the ones who actually make the decisions on who to hire at the presidential level. And this is a very complex job. This isn't just a company that has maybe at most seven distinct services. This is an organization with over 100 separate, you know, thousands of different separate services and nuances to it. It's a very complex organization, and it requires very skilled leadership.
We're speaking today with Dr. Cameron Martin. He is Associate Commissioner for Economic Development and Planning at the Utah System of Higher Education, and we're talking about the search for a new president at the University of Utah. What would you like to see from this position? 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. If you're a professor or a student at the university, what skill set would you like this new president to have? Cameron Martin, I want to talk about salary. I mean, the Board of Regents just upped the salary for this position to, I think it's $360,000 a year.
Correct.
I'm wondering if that's good enough to attract the kind of candidate that you're looking for. This person has to be dynamic, has to be smart, has to be a negotiator, et cetera, et cetera.
Speaking of negotiations, it's not really a smart thing to do to throw out that figure out publicly, right, and say, hey, let's begin negotiations at this mark. But the reality is it's a public institution. Those salaries are public information. It's part of the public trust, which we maintain. So you're correct that is the salary, but it may need to be noted that President Young left and basically doubled what his income was. So it is a touchy situation, particularly this time. But the reality is the Board of Regents want to make sure that our presidents are that they are being compensated fairly into a market that retains that talent here, and not and they're not headhunted away. We have excellent presidents. And so this, as stewards, the Board of Regents are trying to keep the costs down. I promise you, the whole discussion is about how do you keep the costs down as far as you can, but the reality of the market in which we operate and how do you attract that talent. And they're trying to do their best. They're doing a study of peer institutions, nationally, things to understand what the market is doing. And they're not out there to hire somebody at the highest possible point, price point. They're trying to do it at the most conservative way that attracts the right talent. And trust me, an incoming president, he or she is going to be very savvy. They're going to understand the waters in which they're going to be swimming in, and they don't want to be stuck out there with high salary. They're going to negotiate, and they're going to come in at a reasonable sum that is on par with what the market dictates.
What kind of response have you been getting in terms of applicants? Are you seeing a wave of people sending you resumes, or is it kind of trickle here, you know, one here, one there? And do you expect an avalanche as the deadline approaches?
You know, it comes in spurts. It's like going to the grocery store and there's nobody in line for hours, and then all of a sudden, bam, everybody's in line. So the applications, if you will, or the nominations, they come in spurts, particularly after we have opportunities like we're having now to bring attention to the search, which is great. We currently have a pool of nominees. We have strategically waited till the end of this month, so we would be in sync with our national search firm, who's been hired to help enrich that pool. Well, we'll transfer those nominees into candidates. We'll contact them privately. Do you want to be considered? Mm-hmm. This is the position profile. This is what is expected of it. Do you want to be a candidate? And then as that process progresses, the search committee will then read through those applications and make a recommendation to the Board of Regents of 3 to 5 people. Those names will be released publicly. Those individuals will be hosted on campus for a chance for a group of faculty, staff, students, and the cabinet to interact with. That helps the candidate also say, am I a fit, right? Those who the search committee pass on to the regents, they could all do it. It's a matter of fit at that point. Who brings the right feel, the chemistry to that position within the state structure of the system as well as within the institutional structure?
How much weight does it throw into the mix if the candidate has existing ties to the state of Utah or to the institutions? I remember when President Young was hired, much was made of he had educational background here, he had family here, and a history with Utah. I'm wondering if that is a contributing factor that the Presidential Search Committee will be looking at.
Sure. It is. I would say it's probably more of a factor for the candidate. Is it the draw of the homeland, right, to come back home, if you will, more so than it is for the search committee? The search committee is looking at merit of each candidate. Does he or she have what we think we need to have in the next president? And all these open constituent meetings we've been hosting has helped shape the lens through which the search committee will see these applications. Right, so that they're looking at and understanding from the feedback from the students or the faculty what we're looking for. That helps shape that sift, if you will, that lens which they sift through all the applications and make those recommendations of finalists.
Got about 10 seconds. So when is your deadline, and when is this process, when are you going to stop public involvement in the process?
Open till filled. How's that in the 10 seconds? Open till filled, truly. We'll go on until we have those finalist names released.
Okay. Cameron Martin, he's with the Utah System of Higher Education. Cameron, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you.
And we'll have a link on our website with the application and the presidential search website at kcpw.org. City Views is a production of KCPW News with help from Eric Ray and Jesse Ellis. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Join us tomorrow.